This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Last week I said that I was going to talk about, I was wearing our new t-shirt that we made and this phrase that we've been throwing around, or I've been throwing around for the last few years, about meditate and destroy. And I was wearing the t-shirt last week and I was going to give the talk, and then I didn't get to it because there's a lot of questions. And so tonight's topic is meditate and destroy, which begs the question, and a question that I'm often asked, and I think many people that wear our merch are often asked, destroy what? That seems kind of violent for a Buddhist. How do these things fit? Meditation and destruction. I thought we were supposed to like meditate and then create a peaceful universe or something. And it's a simple answer, of course. The Buddha's teachings are aimed, and the meditation practices are aimed at the alleviation of suffering, at the end, or we could say the destruction of suffering and the things that cause suffering. The meditation to destroy greed and hatred and delusion. And I think, as I say it, it's a catchy, I like it, sort of catchy, meditate and destroy. Do you guys know where it comes from? The skate and destroy? In the 1980s, Thrasher magazine, a skateboard magazine, had a logo and I think, you know, some merch, t-shirts and hats that said skate and destroy. And there was a punk band in San Jose, California, called The Faction in the early 80s, the bass player was a professional skateboarder named Steve Caballero, and they had a song called Skate and Destroy, and I'm not sure if they got that from Thrasher or Thrasher got Skate and Destroy from The Faction. Do you know? So, The Faction bowing down to Iggy and the Stooges makes sense. Search and destroy, skate and destroy, meditate and destroy is the lineage. Now that you know the lineage, Iggy probably got it from someone else. The military, Vietnam, Burroughs. But I was just, as I was saying it, I was thinking, meditate and destroy isn't quite right. It should be more like Dharma. Because the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion, meditation is one of the tools, but it's not the only tool. In order to end suffering, the alleviation of suffering and that which causes suffering in our lives and in this world, meditation is very central, very important, but it's bigger than just meditation. It is ethical behavior, it's renunciation. It's the practice of generosity, the practice of kindness and compassion and forgiveness. Practice of right livelihood and right speech, the Eightfold Path. It's a way of life. It's a way of being. It's not just meditation. Meditation is a core chunk of what is going to end suffering in your life and in this world. But it's not the only tool. It's one of an assortment of actions. Meditation through mindfulness practice, the way that we're doing tonight, does a lot to alleviate and to transform and to destroy greed through bringing present time awareness. We pay attention. What's happening here now in my body, with my breath, with my emotions, with my mind, what's happening, and how clearly we begin to see through mindfulness how much greed there is inside of us, how we're wired and conditioned with greed for pleasant experiences. Perhaps you've noticed as you sit here and try to meditate, there's all of this craving, all of this wanting, all of this, you know, greed in its subtler forms is just attachment, is just clinging, is just craving, is just the thought, I would be happy if I was comfortable. I would be happy if A, B, C, D, whatever your mind, all of that are the subtler forms of greed. And it's built into us, our survival instinct, our very core survival instinct, we could call greed. Greed for pleasure. And all of the ways that that manifests. Mindfulness begins to destroy that greed because we catch it at its root. We see it as it arises. We see what's happening inside of us. We see how our mind is working, how the heart is working, how the body is responding to pleasure, craving for pleasure. And we begin to replace the old habitual, reactive, greed-based actions with a response of non-clinging. Mindfulness leads to non-greed. Mindfulness destroys greed. Does that make sense to you? Do you see do you make the bridge? As you pay attention to what's happening, you see how greed is manifesting, attachment, craving, clinging, all by itself. You're not greedy. Greed is arising in your body. Greed for pleasure, craving, lust for sex, thoughts about I'll be happy if, wanting, accumulation, all of that stuff is happening all by itself inside of us. We are born into an experience that we can call greed. It's not your fault. It's just your survival instinct. It's the evolved human experience. It's just the way it is. But it causes all of this suffering in our life when we're not relating to it wisely. When we're believing it, when we're following it, when we're letting it dictate our actions and our relationships and the way we are in the world, when we're acting in a greedy way, it's a real fucking problem. The fact that we feel it, no problem. If we respond to it with non-identification, mindfulness gives us hope to end an unwise relationship to greed, to craving, to clinging, to attachment. Without mindfulness, I think we're completely fucked. I think that it's almost hopeless to end greed and to end the suffering of greed without a practice of mindfulness, of clear, present awareness of how it's arising, and then how to bring the antidote, how to begin practicing generosity, how to begin practicing service, how to begin practicing non-clinging appreciation to pleasure, rather than hostage-taking towards pleasure. Makes sense? Any clarifications about how mindfulness destroys greed before I go on to hatred and delusion? Mindfulness destroys greed because you see it and you change your relationship to it. Was there a hand?
You got it there. I was wondering. I didn't make the connection because observation in itself isn't destruction. So you need to talk about changing your relationship based on the observation.
The observation is the first piece. And then there is an action. First you see this is happening, you acknowledge this is happening inside of you, and then you see, oh, this is happening for everyone. And then there's action. It's not just the observation. And I think that this is important that Asher is bringing up. Sometimes mindfulness is treated as just observation. There is an action that is being asked for. Non-clinging, letting go is part of it. Mindfulness of the body puts you in contact with what's happening. First foundation of mindfulness. Second foundation of mindfulness, investigating the feeling tone. Is it pleasant? Okay. If it's pleasant, how are you relating to the pleasure? What's the appropriate action, right? Because usually, status quo, pleasure, attachment, greed, clinging. Without mindfulness, it's an almost automatic clinging to pleasure. With mindfulness, there's an opportunity. There's free will. You can say, oh, this is really pleasant, and I can see the desire for more and the clinging to it, but you can choose, oh, I can just let this be impermanent. And that's the key. This is one of the keys. This is one of the ways one of the key insights, is that mindfulness shows us the impermanent nature, how everything that's happening is changing. No matter what it is, it's a thought, it's coming, it's going. It's a sensation, it's arising and passing. It's an emotion, it's coming through. Nothing is constant. Nothing is permanent. Mindfulness shows us that directly, clearly, in our own experience. Not theoretically, but you know it for yourself directly. Through observation. And then there is, what's the wise response to this impermanent pleasure? Because my habit is to cling to it, but it's impermanent. And so when I cling to it, I get the rope burns of trying to hold on to something that is being pulled beyond my grasp. I can't keep it. I want to keep it. I want to keep it and accumulate more and more and more, but it's impossible, completely impossible. So mindfulness shows us that and then encourages us to let go. And that's what's going to destroy the habitual clinging and the greed, the destruction of greed. I think one of the other Dharma pieces around destroying greed and clinging and attachment, and it is said, it is often popularly said, that when the Buddha would come to new places, when he would teach people for the first time, he actually wouldn't start with meditation or mindfulness, that he would start with generosity as the antidote to greed. And he would encourage people to start giving even before they start sitting. That generosity is a practice that will end some of the suffering in our life around clinging and around craving and around the delusion that we'll be happy if we have more. And so along with mindfulness and changing our relationship to pleasure and our greed-based, clinging-based relationship to pleasure, also an engagement and action that on a daily basis says, how can I help others? What do I have to give? How can I be part of the solution? In ancient times in India, and to this day in India, and in most places in our country as well, there are people who don't have enough food to eat. And one of the practical suggestions that the Buddha gave was that we share some of each meal with those who are in need. That every day we see, you know, who can I feed? Who's hungry? And said, if we really get to know the value of generosity, that we wouldn't let a single meal go by without sharing some of it with others. So this is a way that Dharma, meditation, and generosity begin to destroy greed, begin to end the suffering of greed. The suffering of hatred, sometimes it means resentment, it means ill will, it means actually hating. Sometimes it's just the suffering of not being very good at tolerating pain, at hating pain. Just in your meditation tonight, that inability to meet pain with compassion, you could call that hatred, aversion, resentment, pushing away, a form of what's being referred to as the cause of suffering in the form of hatred and aversion. Mindfulness allows us to see what's happening as it happens. We see what's happening as our body gets uncomfortable, as unpleasant emotions come in, as unpleasant thoughts arise. We see our habit of wanting to get rid of them, of wanting to ignore them or suppress them. And then we are faced with a choice, with an opportunity. Again, awareness of what's happening and the encouragement to begin trying to bring compassion rather than hatred to pain. Compassion is the antidote to suffering about pain. When we learn to care about it, we learn to be friendly towards it. It takes some time. It's like that first question. I don't think any of us can just go from our status quo survival instinct, I hate pain, right to be compassionate. It's not, you can't just hear that and do it. Meditation over months and years will teach you how to do it. It's a skill. It's a practice developed skill. Especially when it comes to one's own pain. It is unnatural to meet your own pain with compassion. It is totally natural to hate your pain. If you hate your pain, you're normal. If you've been meditating for a while and you no longer hate your pain and now you meet it with compassion, you're abnormal. You're fucking weird.
Can you talk about just what does that look like, meeting it with compassion?
I don't have any idea what it looks like. It's a feeling. It's an internal relationship. So I think it can look different on the surface to different people in different situations. But part of it is tolerance, is the willingness to be with, without running from. So whatever that looks like, being with sometimes. There's a softness usually to it. There's a quality of friendliness. It's an internal relationship to it. It's a willingness to be with. It's a friendliness towards, a caring about. The word karuna, that means compassion, from the Pali language, close to what the Buddha spoke, early Buddhist language, translates as a quivering of the heart in response to pain. So, what's that look like when your heart is being moved in response to pain? And I think that most of us have at least some experience of what that means towards others. You know what it means to be compassionate? Somebody you really care about is really suffering and you really care about their pain? Without a kind of codependent, I need your pain to go away. But really just, I know I can't do shit about your pain, but I really care about it. I know I can't make it go away, but I love you, and I'm here for you in any way that I can be. Not stop crying, not, you know, feel better, but I have space for your pain. You know that feeling of compassion towards someone else? Your heart is moved, you care about them. That's what compassion is. Now we just have to learn to do that towards ourselves. My heart is moved. I care about my own pain. Friendly, present, loving, even towards my pain, not just others. From the inside out. Able to tolerate, make space for, be with pain without hatred. Now, I think it gets more complicated and a bit more tricky because in no way is what being asked for a sort of masochistic, now just be with pain, accept all pain all of the time. There's a discernment that's being asked for, which is if the pain is unavoidable, your only option is compassion. If the pain is avoidable, do something about it. There are times when you can do something to alleviate the suffering. But there's a lot of times where you can't do anything. And so then your job is compassion. So then you're only left with compassion. Does that make sense? There is discernment being asked for. We're not saying, like, just find pain and sit in it all the time. Find joy when joy is appropriate. But when there's no joy to be experienced, and what's really happening is heartbreak and physical pain and sickness and old age and death and grief and all of that difficult, unavoidable stuff that we're all faced with, compassion is necessary if you don't want to suffer. Without compassion, we will suffer immensely. Because without compassion, what we have is hatred of the reality that life is often unpleasant, often painful. Meditation helps to destroy the hatred of pain and to replace it with compassion. It takes a while to get there, but all you have to do is hear this, or you heard it 5 years ago, and then you're practicing it, you're putting it, you're implementing it, you're building that skill. Then it might take a decade or two to become a little bit more proficient at compassion for your own pain. But it will happen slowly over your daily meditation practice, your daily practice of compassion, your retreat practice, your generosity practice. You will become a more compassionate person. Your heart will be more easily moved towards your own pain and the pain of others through the practice of meditation. Hatred will be diminished and diminished and diminished until it is destroyed, until it is annihilated. Skate and destroy. The third traditional thing to talk about ending is delusion. Greed for pleasure, craving, clinging, attachment, hatred, aversion, denial, all of that stuff, that dysfunctional relationship to pain, replacing it with compassion. And then all of the ways that we become deluded. Meditation, mindfulness, wisdom that comes from meditation, that comes from Dharma practice, will destroy the delusion of permanence. Almost all of us are conditioned with some sort of delusion around things can be permanent. Do you think things can be permanent? Many of us, you know, even though we say no, I know even to myself, I still, there's places where I hold, even after 20-something years of meditation, where I still hold some delusions around something's got to last. Something's got to be permanent in here. And even if we see it about our material things and we see it about other people, sometimes we take that delusion of permanence and we turn it into some sort of spiritual philosophy around a soul that lasts forever or a self that is unchanging. And impermanence applies to everything, even you, not just your body, from this Buddhist perspective. And that believing that there is any permanent being, any self that is unchanging, any soul that was born and that dies and that is unchanging, from a Buddhist perspective, is a delusion, is a fantasy, is a story that we're making up so that we have some comfort around self. It's a comforting delusion. Meditation is asking us to destroy even that security blanket of self, of I am. And whether it is I am this body, or I am this mind, or I am the spirit that is experiencing whatever bullshit story we heard. I'm the knower. I'm the experiencer. I'm the witness. Anything that is clung to as I am, the Buddha says, is a delusion. You can't cling to anything. And this is where, you know, the ground really gets pulled from us. The destruction of all created comforting philosophies. The destruction of the pulling the rug out from under our feet that there is anything permanent. Now, when it comes to this conversation about self, sometimes Buddhism will say no self. Some forms of Buddhism will say you will awaken to the reality of no self. I think it's a bad, personally, I think it's a bad translation. That what the Buddha, I think, was pointing to was the impermanent nature of self. There is a self. We all have the feeling of I am. There is a self. It's just not permanent. There's not no self. There's no permanent abiding self. The self is an impermanent changing process. It is not unchanging. So many delusions that most of them have to do with greed and hatred, I think. Destroy the delusion that we often carry that says, I'll be happy when. And that delusion, and you have your own flavor of it, I'll be happy when I'm rich and famous. I'll be happy when I have X amount of money in my savings. Like, I'll be happy when I pay off my student loans. Fuck savings. I'll be happy when I have the right car, the right relationship, the right face tattoos. Whatever it is, it might make you happy. I guess if we kind of can just change that story a little bit and kind of be honest with ours and say, I will have temporary pleasure when I get. It's not going to be everlasting happiness. If you get the relationship, the money, the promotion, the whatever it is you want, it will give you a temporarily pleasant experience. That is true. It will not be the source of everlasting happiness if it is a material thing. It will not. It never has been. It never will be. But it will feel good. Nothing wrong with that. Destroying the delusion that keep us stuck, that keep us so disappointed when we get what we want. As somebody said, the only thing more disappointing than not getting what you want is getting what you want. You get what you want. You thought, fuck, I was so sure I'd be happy. I was so convinced. Unless, perhaps, unless what you want more than anything is liberation. But as long as what you want and you think is going to make you happy is some sort of material thing, some sort of accumulation or attention or even relationship, even a loving relationship with someone else, unless it's from within you, unless it's liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion, it's not going to do the trick. But if it is in conjunction with liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion, destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion, then the relationship will be practice. The material things will be practice. The losses will be practices. All of it, life, becomes practice. And a practice of being liberated in the midst of pleasure, in the midst of pain, in the midst of gain and loss, praise and blame, in the impermanent nature of all things, where we can't hold on to anything or anybody without suffering. Then we have a practice, we have mindfulness, non-attached, present time, non-judgmental awareness. We have compassion for the pain. We learn compassion. We have non-attached appreciation towards pleasure. With the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion come a life worth living. Come liberation. Come a way of being in this world where you still feel all of the pain. You still feel it. It does not end pain. I did not say the destruction of pain. It does not end the pain in your life. But it ends the suffering about the pain, the hatred of the pain. It replaces it with compassion. This is possible for each one of us. It does not end the pleasure, only the clinging to pleasure, only the suffering of being attached. And non-attachment is not detachment. It is not separate from, it is not avoidance. Non-attachment is connected. This is non-attachment. You are connected to what's happening. You're connected to your family, to your children, to your parents, to your community. Non-attached means feeling present, compassionate, connected to. So often we think of non-attached as separate from, avoiding, disconnected, detached. Non-attached means that you are with who you're with, what's happening, and how it feels present and connected. Just not trying to control, just not clinging. Does that make sense? Ultimately, I feel like a big piece of what we're going for is the destruction of our small-mindedness, our self-centeredness. Most of us start Dharma practice because of our own suffering. And we're motivated to end our own suffering. But if you're serious about practice, a shift will happen where it will become less about yourself and selfish self-help, and it will become more about an altruistic, healthy desire to create a positive change. And that self that was so, had so much suffering, that was so motivated to get here in the first place, you'll have such a different relationship to that part of your past. And that your practice will continue, hopefully for the rest of your life, but not motivated by your own suffering, more and more motivated about being part of the solution. More and more altruistic, more and more bodhisattva-like practice for the benefit of all living beings, sharing the blessings of your own liberation, of your own spiritual awakening, being of service, being generous, doing your practice not just for yourself, but for the whole community. And that may have already happened for some of you. And if you stick with the practice, it will happen. And some traditions would say, actually, let's get you on that motivation right from the beginning for the benefit of all others. Let's get that bodhisattva compassion ethic out front and it's really wise. It's right there with compassion. It's right there with generosity, with service. In our tradition, we tend to say, no, get your own house in order completely first. Really do your practice. It's actually okay to be selfish about your practice. The Buddha was for 7 years. He spent 7 years training his mind, training his heart, and then spent the rest of his life being of service. So you can do your own practice for the next 7 years or so. Just really trying to get your shit together. But not the rest of your life. At some point it needs to shift. It needs to become an offering. And not just a receiving. These are some of my thoughts. Any questions, comments, clarifications? Please.
Just curious what your thoughts were on in terms of impermanence and non-attachment in terms of relationships and, you know, marriage and all that kind of stuff. Much deeper than both people have an understanding of. We're both going to die. Anything can kind of happen. But more in relation to, like, we're talking about before about, I think you said the low rise starting broken. Just in relation to that, of how, where the strength and the cultivating of something between two people can come from both people in that kind of space.
It's really wild to be in a relationship if you're not in denial about impermanence. And about the fact that you're signing up for grief. That the consequence of love in this world is grief. And that it's inescapable. And that it's going to happen. If you're in relationship, there's going to be sorrow. There's going to be an end to that relationship. It's for sure. I mean, I don't know how much more to say about it other than it's just what we are working with. It's what we're practicing with. And it's so much different to go into relationships, and not just our loving sexual relationships, but even just our friendships, each communication with this wisdom view that knows this is impermanent. This is going to change. This is going to end. This moment that we're having right now is precious and original and will never happen again. That one, it's the one that we just had, dead. It's over. It feels like it is the practice, that this is the relationship practice of just being with the truth of constantly ending impermanence. And it's perhaps interesting if you're in a relationship with somebody who has that full awareness, but it's not necessary, right? It's your practice. It can be difficult, perhaps if you're in a relationship with somebody who has no sort of acceptance and wisdom around impermanence. I can imagine that being pretty challenging. I mean, everybody has some sense of it. My wife likes to remind me that on our first date, I started talking to her about impermanence. And, a little too soon for that conversation. I think that if we really wanted to be quite Buddhist, we couldn't really get married with the way that the Western "I love you forever" kind of is set up, and that maybe the Buddhist way to enter into a long-term commitment, marriage, relationship would be to be a little bit more honest and humble and say, like, in this moment, I feel like I want to be with you forever. But we'll see.
Those were your vows?
Those were my inner vows. That's what I was saying inside. As externally, I was saying, yeah, forever, sure. I do. You want me to go into denial of reality for this half-hour ceremony? I'm all for it. It is my intention to go for it. Right in this moment. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for tonight. Don't tell my wife I said that.
She's going to hear it.
She knows. Oh, yeah, she really listens to the podcast. As always, what we offer here at Against the Stream, what I say, what all of our teachers say, what all Buddhist teachers say, as far as I'm concerned, is not to be believed. Is not to be taken on faith or blind following or taken wholesale as completely true, but that these are things for you to reflect on, that your job as the listener, as the student, is to reflect on these things and find out for yourself what's true. To look deeply at your relationship to pleasure, your relationship to pain, your relationship to permanence and to self. And find out for yourself what's causing suffering, what's ending suffering, what brings about more happiness and less confusion to your life. And Buddhism is really about empowering us to do the work ourselves, giving us the tools to do the work ourselves. So don't take my word for any of this stuff, but find out for yourself what's practical, what's applicable, and do the practice. And, you know, don't make any decisions too soon. You know, do the practice for like 10 years and then decide if it works. And if it doesn't work after a decade or so, if you're still as miserable and selfish and confused of a decade of serious meditation practice, then maybe you're in the wrong tradition. I think that's it for tonight. Thank you for your practice tonight. Thank you in advance for any generosity that you are able to leave with us. And may any blessings that come from our practice be shared outward in all directions. May all beings benefit from the wisdom that we develop together. And together may we create a positive change in this world. Sorry for keeping you late.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.